Well, here's to another interesting case that has some really good case law on the issue. Let's tell everybody what it is, because we're just we've been immersed in this for a while.
So we have a case which has been ongoing for quite some time, where there is a particular issue about the mental intent, and this will have significant precedent value for future cases. It's a sexual assault, a sexual exploitation. But I want to come at this a slightly different way, almost an academic way. Pardon me to all our viewers, okay? So under the Criminal Code of Canada, there is no consent obtained if the complainant is incapable of consenting to the activity for any reason other than the one referred to in other sections, or if the accused, and this is where it is, induces the complainant to engage in the activity by abusing a position of trust, power, or authority.
So some of those, I think, are fairly understandable. So somebody who, say, a police officer is in a position of authority, and a teacher would be in a position of trust, or we've had cases that I've been reading where it was like a religious leader. You ended up with a young person that they were in a position of trust with. So those things people don't have trouble understanding, but the one that you emphasize, power, is becoming a little bit problematic, shall we say.
So let's just discuss for a moment. I told you I'm going to be a bit academic here, okay? So the case of Snellgrove, Snellgrove, 2019, SCC 2nd, 53 CR 745. The aim of section 273.1 sub 2 is to protect the vulnerable and weak and to preserve the right to fully choose to consent to sexual activity. Inducing consent by abusing the relationships described in this section does not imply some kind of coercion, as in contemplated by another section, but abusing a position of trust or authority or power over another by the use of personal feelings, confidence, endearment, or other factors. Okay, so.
Endearment.
Odd term. Leaving that aside. So I think we can agree that we understand fairly well positions of authority or trust. Patient, doctor, teacher, student, police officer, accused, or yeah, traffic thing, employer, employee sometimes, although those are not as clear. But we understand what a relationship of trust is. A parent, a babysitter, those are all positions we understand. You know, we see it, like you said, within congregations, whether it's a priest or a pastor or a rabbi or whatever, a religious leader, in, you know, camps where you have counselors, all that stuff we can understand a little bit better. One area which is not litigated very much and is really unclear is power.
Mm-hmm.
Abusing a position of power. And hold on a second. You talked about this a long time ago in one of our episodes, where really, what does that mean? And it can mean a lot of things.
So yeah, like we were saying before, if you're a celebrity, well, can you have a relationship with anybody who's, you know, not a celebrity? Or what if you're like a really A-list, high-level actor? Can you date an actor who's just starting out? You know, what about if you're wealthy? Can you date somebody who's not as wealthy as you? We were laughing too, saying, oh, you could be dating somebody that's totally fine, and then all of a sudden you get a promotion. Oops, sorry, honey, got to break up. Yes. We're not allowed to date anymore. I mean, it can get into the ridiculous. But one of the ones that we've come across a few times is where, even if you're not charged with that particular point of an exploitation, it'll still factor in on a lot of sexual assault cases if there's a big age difference.
Yes. So we can set that example up. So let me just put to all of you. The first issue for us to consider, and I think the main issue here, is whether the determination of an inducement to sexual activity by the abuse of power is subjective or objective. Told you we're going to be a bit academic here. So let's set this up. What can be factors of power? An age difference, financial status, celebrity status, education. What else am I missing?
Well, there's also an issue if somebody is an addict and it's they're seen as vulnerable.
A vulnerability.
And, you know, we've had cases too where both people were addicts and it didn't factor in that this person was also vulnerable, right? That, you know, they're in a similar condition. And that's, in fact, one of the reasons they spent so much time together. So, you know, it's again a situation where, like we've seen with somebody who's intoxicated, and so's, you know, both people are intoxicated, but the male is seen to be more responsible for the decision-making of the female, even though they're both intoxicated. Same thing with, you know, if you were looking at drug abuse, and, you know, it's always kind of focused on victim-centered, where they like to presume somebody's a victim.
Okay, so that's a good point. So let's frame this. Okay, let's frame, strike a pose. Okay, so let's frame. I did see Madonna. I saw her recently. Okay. Yeah, it was cool. This really bothers me. So this is why I want to take it slow. Because if we don't get this right in law, it could be really f***ed up. Okay? So let's create a scenario. The complainant is 21 years of age, has a minor drug addiction. The accused is 45 years of age, is a doctor, and earns...
Well, trained. It wasn't actually a full...
We're using a total hypothetical right now. I'm just creating a hypothetical. Is a doctor and earns about $350,000 a year. The complainant works as a barista. That's our scenario. If this is an objective analysis, you could say age difference, financial difference, educational difference, slight addiction, person's a doctor, maybe they might not be helping them with their addiction, or maybe in some respects, you know, what's that term, enabling. Objectively, you could, if it's an objective analysis, a solely objective analysis, say there's no way that there can be consent to any sexual interaction between those two parties. Okay, frame that. Did I miss anything? This is a hypothetical.
Yeah. Objectively, because the subjective is important.
Is it?
We don't know.
Like, we did research. Like, it's like a lot of research. And this is before the court on a slightly different set of facts. But no, we did research, and there's not one clear case that's telling us with power.
Yeah, well, there has
And there was a real push. You raised this issue. It was a great issue. This is now going back 2 years ago or longer for this podcast that's been around for so long. That the push from certain feminist groups was that the power dynamic always vitiates consent.
Well, that's, yeah, some of the, you know, like Catherine McKinnon and people in that era, there were a lot of times where people were saying that women can't consent to, well, they actually called it PIV, penis and vagina, that PIV was always rape. There was actually like an article written titled that, and this
Sorry,
was
say that slowly again, because I only had coffee. If I had scotch now, like we did before, this would make more sense. What the f-?
This is how, you know, things go. They actually referred to normal intercourse as PIV, penis in vagina, and there's an article written of somebody who followed all the works of Andrea Dworkin, Catherine McKinnon, and other people in that era, and wrote an article called PIV is rape. All PIV is rape. And this is a common way of seeing it for radical feminists.
Right, but there was another push, I remember reading, that because of the inherent power imbalance between certain people, you can never have consent.
Well, in this case, they were saying male and female because of patriarchy, right. And so females can't consent because of the power difference.
Right.
They're not that extreme anymore, but you see variations of this popping up all the time.
Right, but within this paradigm that we have now in this hypothetical, you can see that it can easily be constructed that these set of facts would automatically vitiate the consent. Mm-hmm. From an objective standpoint, they have more money, they have an education, the complainant's vulnerable. All these things would mean that there is an imbalance in power.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's an objective analysis of those set of facts, can be convicted. No consent.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'd mentioned something to do with the intent earlier, and that's referred to as mens rea, and it's actus reus is the actual act, which is the objective side, and then the mens rea is whether or not the person understood or were intended to do something rather, and that's an important element. Pretty much in all charges, the Crown always has to prove mens rea. But in this case, it seems to be kind of slid over because they're just vitiating consent because of these objective facts. Well, we see that argued by the Crown anyway, because it's quite common when there's a big age difference that age difference is going to be raised in the Crown submissions.
So let's be, clear. The case law is fairly certain that the mere existence, just bringing you along on my academic study here, the mere existence of a relationship of trust or power authority is insufficient to vitiate consent to sexual activity. But the Crown must prove an incitement or inducement of sexual activity by abusing a position of power. Again, though, the discussion with respect to power is it an objective analysis? And this is the problem that I have with any argument that this could be objective. It has to be subjective. So I wanted to bring this along and see what people will say when this drops and what people's comments are. But in our research and our argument, which I think many other people would agree with, is it has to be subjective analysis because the language implies that there has to be some active participation, meaning intent of the accused to abuse this position.
Right. And that's where you have to tie that subjectiveness in there, is that the word abuse, implies that there was some sort of intentional harm done.
Some intentional harm, some intentional misuse of power. And power in itself is, a dynamic concept, not merely a static concept. And there has to be some intent to take that dynamic and therefore create an inducement and abuse it. And therefore, you have to find the subjective intent to do it. Otherwise, you would go back to an analysis that, frankly, would run contrary to Snellgrove, that mere existence of the relationship would be sufficient, right? And it's not.
Right. Well, it shouldn't be. But they keep adding in more, it seems to me, they keep adding more and more factors that can vitiate or nullify somebody's consent.
But the problem with power is that it's so intoxicating of a concept for those who want to argue certain issues that by acting upon a relationship where you have such an age gap, in and of itself, is an abuse of power. So it's this is a dangerous thing where I think we're hoping that in this case and in future cases, it'll be very clear that the analysis must have a subjective intent.
Well, there's an interesting case that we've referenced a number of times about stereotypes, Codwat case, in which it was overturned on appeal when he was convicted because, and there was an age difference in there where there was, I think, 17-year-old woman and he was, I think, around 40 or such. There was a pretty big age difference. And he was convicted because the judge didn't think that that a young woman would consent to sex with a man that much older than her. And so that was seen to be a stereotype about women, about who they might decide they want to have sex with. But then it's a little bit different to say, you know, to come at it from a stereotype approach, and then just to say that that they had power, right? So they're not saying, oh, well, she wouldn't have, or no young woman would have done this thing, but to say that it doesn't matter because the age difference is significant enough. And then if they were to decide that, what's the age difference? Can we know? Because there's a lot of people who date each other with a 20-year age difference. And is it only a factor if the younger person is, you know, really young, like 18, 20?
Look, there can be circumstances where you have such a significant gap. But, you know, we've heard of relationships in the media, like celebrity relationships, where you have like somebody extremely young and somebody much, much older. And that's not a sexual assault relationship. Mm-hmm. But I just think it's important because in so many other cases that's come before the court, there's an obvious state of mind of an accused to abuse this position. I mean, there's just obvious. So, for example, there's been situations where the complainant is a drug user and then the accused happened to supply drugs actively to enable the addiction where they were not a drug addict, right? What you were alluding to earlier is the case that we have before the courts. Both were addicts. Right. So when one was getting drugs for the other, they both were just basically drug buddies, right? Yeah. So it's not really a power dynamic in that regard. But, you know, we know in other instances where there is a supplier of drugs, that's clearly acting upon a position of power and taking advantage of a vulnerable individual who's addicted to drugs. But when you look at the plethora of cases that talk about this type of exploitation, it really moves towards a subjective inquiry about not just the complainant's state of mind, but the accused state of mind, so that you don't have an accidental abuse of power, right? Like, just think about that for a second.
It's important that people can understand if they're breaking the law or not. Like, you know, having an ignorance of what the law means and what the law isn't an excuse.
No.
But it has to be understandable when it is that, you know, in the law and the way it's, you know, the way it's broken down in court in terms of the way they interpret words, right? It has to match up with what people could reasonably expect.
In order, so ignorance of the law is never a defense, but in a position of power, I would think as a subjective mind, you have to be, in order to abuse it, you have to recognize it in the first place, right?
Yeah. And
that would require understanding the state of mind of the accused and therefore their intent.
And we have to keep in mind that power is more than just those factors we've listed, actually, that we've made this point as well, that youth and beauty can actually be power in a relationship. And, you know, there's different factors in both partners in a relationship that can increase or decrease their power. And youth and beauty is definitely one of them.
Talk about that for a moment, because, you know, in certain cases we may have, there can be the argument if you have somebody who's significantly older and there's the allegation of sexual assault, it's almost presumed that the person is acting upon the age. And because of that age difference, they're abusing a position of power or trust.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the flip side can be youth and attractiveness can in fact be not only an inducement, it can be power.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of relationships and it's quite common for older women to be in relationships with younger men as well. And that youth is definitely a factor. And it can be, especially, you know, once you reach a certain age, it can be really flattering when, you know, a young person, you know, expresses attraction to you. And it makes you feel young again. And that definitely ends up influencing the decision making. And it is absolutely a form of power.
Hmm. What are you saying? I'm older, you're younger?
Yeah.
Okay. No, but I'm glad we've come back to this because we've had this case going on for so long. We've all been involved in drafting and litigating this case. And I just find that the area of power in and of itself, with all of the noise that goes around sexual relationships, makes it very easy to draw a conclusion that somebody abused a position of power merely because of the existence of the factors. I'm not saying that's the law. I think the law is clear that it says the mere existence of these factors is not enough. And I think somebody will understand, hopefully, that there has to be a mental intent to abuse that position, which includes, of course, acknowledging and knowing that you're in that position of power and then acting on it. It seems to me to be pretty trite and pretty simple, but it was surprising how the court and the Crown and others in the case we had were struggling to find cases to support this position, which I thought, and you thought, when drafting actual submissions was like, yeah, it's a no-brainer.
I just couldn't see where this power or authority came from, because in this particular case, the two charges are intricately linked, because
in this case, the person was actually charged with both sexual assault and sexual exploitation. You can just have a charge of sexual assault, but have it vitiated under consent section by having an abuse of a power relationship.
Yeah, because in this particular case, there's open admission from the complainant that she was consenting, and then just came to think later that that it was wrong, that that this relationship occurred.
That it was
and
exploitive.
It got framed as exploitation or power. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they have to come to a determination in this case that there was not just power, but an abuse of that power, an intention to use that power in order to basically coerce the person into the relationship.
And maybe for some reason, I'm just making more of this than I should. It might be, you know, the court might just conclude to go, of course, there has to be a mental intent to abuse and therefore induce the sex. That goes without saying. I don't know. I got hung up on it because the argument that was going on and the lack of cases specifically with respect to power were few and far between. And maybe I missed stuff. I mean, I don't know. Maybe somebody who's viewing this might go, hey, schmuck, you missed this case. But we didn't find it specifically. And it's rearing its head more and more. And it's very dangerous, the set of facts that we had, where somebody 2 or 3 years later has
reframed
and relabeled what happened because they've come to feel that that relationship was exploitive. Mm-hmm. And the language that was used by this particular individual was so interesting. It's like, well, he was a doctor. He was older. He drove a car. What do you think it looks like?
A car with...
And he had an 8-track in the car.
Yeah, I know. That's how new the car was.
Or it's so old, it's back now. It's so in fashion.
It's retro, yeah.
It's retro. It's cool. But it was that thinking, that language, that analysis that the person was going through. It's like, holy f***. Like, you can think of so many situations where somebody, for whatever reason, can be going through something bad in their lives and then come back and think, 5, 6, 7 years, 8, 9, 10 years ago, that was not a healthy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it charged
with
sexual
influence,
assault.
There was influence of other people on that, relabeling as well.
Therapists, and we've had this with, experts we've had on about the danger when somebody's in therapy, possibly for other reasons, mm-hmm. All the time, generally for other reasons, and then they start to examine their life and they go, that relationship wasn't so healthy. That was a highly exploitive. Do you realize that you were influenced and taken advantage of in that relationship? I mean, that f***ing happened in this case. That's exactly what happened in this case.
But here's the thing that really fascinated me, and this is why I'm saying I just don't see how it's possible. Like, I mean, this would be really dangerous as a precedent if there was a conviction.
I don't think it will happen. We have a particularly intelligent and experienced judge.
Let me say why. Because in the statements, there's an admission by the complainant. She says, I was 100% manipulating him, the accused. She actually says 100% she was manipulating him.
Yeah, I thought this was a slam dunk. I thought this was like a LeBron three-pointer. like with nobody guarding him. Like, I just thought this was like a no-brainer.
Well, then where do we go with the, you know, subjective sort of issue on this one too? She, in her mind, was the one manipulating him, but then, you know, because of the power, does it negate that, you know, her actual thinking, her intent? She had an intent to manipulate him
at the time
and admitted that she had the intent to manipulate
him. There's real-time evidence through messages and then within the statement of the complainant, of the complainant wanting to act upon her manipulation of the accused to further other interests. Mm-hmm. That's like clear in the evidence. So I thought, to again go back to my basketball analogy, that's like a slam dunk for us.
Mm-hmm. I guess the question is, can you be abusing power over somebody who's actually manipulating you?
Three or four years later comes back to think, well, I thought I was manipulating the person, but now, thanks to my therapy, I realize that I was the one being manipulated. Like, how twisted is that?
Mm-hmm. So there's a
dramatic pause.
Yeah.
Boy, we deal with some f***ed up situations. Like,
I know. Well, you know, there were originally other charges in here too, which I think kind of led to this particular claim of abuse.
Doesn't matter.
Power.
Those are gone.
Because I know.
This person is on trial solely for sex assault and charged with exploitation. Solely on, you know, looking back after 3 years when they wanted to manipulate. No, that really wasn't the case. It was an unhealthy relationship, thanks to my therapist telling me that I was the one who was being exploited.
And the other charges were withdrawn at prelim because there was no evidence to support them.
Discharged, but yes, there was
discharged.
No evidence. There's no evidence.
But it just reminds me of another scenario, which I've kind of brought up in terms of how we interpret certain things. And that's in cases of trafficking, right? Or prostitution, rather. It's the prostitution laws I was thinking of, sorry. In prostitution laws, there's an exclusionary clause for people who are in a legitimate living relationship. So they're not living off the avails of prostitution taking the money from them because they're in a relationship and maybe they don't even work themselves, the other person, the partner.
No, you have two people living together. One's a sex worker, the other one isn't. They're sharing their income, but you can't be charged with living off the avails because you're in a legitimate relationship.
Yeah, but then I always had a problem with...
Not sure how well that relationship is going, but who knows?
Yeah. I know, but I always had a problem with the word legitimate. Who decides what's legitimate?
Oh, the people.
Because we have a lot of relationships.
You know, them.
We have a lot of relationships.
Government.
Where a young person will be
Justin.
With a wealthy old person, really just for the money. So, you know, they're in a relationship where they're making a trade. You know? And, you know, this is what really well known that it happens. And I was like, well, would we call that prostitution?
Yeah, but I'm more hung up on, I'm really hung up on power. Because it's something that can be, pardon me to say, it can really be exploited in the future to try and relabel relationships and get historic allegations going because there is this zealousness to try and address inequality. And I'm terrified of that.
Well, you know, and a lot of times too, the people come to misunderstand things like we've talked about, when am I too intoxicated to consent? And so somebody can get charged when the level of intoxication isn't really close enough to the level required. And same
thing. Oh my God, you have no evidence other than somebody saying I was drunk and they still get charged and it's based on incapacity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when it comes out in court that they weren't really that intoxicated or isn't
intoxicated. Or
intoxicated at all. But then, you know, people see these things and there's articles published and there's studies being done about power imbalances. And some people read these and then they start thinking, oh my God, you know, I've been sexually assaulted because of this thing that I read.
Or let's say you've studied it and then did a film about a particular sexual assault or rape or something like that. And then later on come to think, oh my God, I was sexually assaulted by my partner. Trial coming up. Mm-hmm. Wait for this one. That'll be a good few episodes.
Well, and I remember, too, that...
Oh, God, that's going to be a good one.
I know. I remember, too, another thing where somebody came to believe that their body had memories.
Yeah, so... I was just scrolling through some of her old videos, and I was screaming, going, my body remembered.
And this, again, this is stuff that somebody has read, that was presented as like a legitimate
credible
thing.
Evidence, yeah.
And so then they end up making a report based on this, you know, misunderstanding of, well, in that case, how memory works. But there's lots of charges laid because somebody has a misunderstanding of what sexual assault really is.
Right. But let's just drill down on that for a moment. That their misunderstanding is one thing, but we have people in positions of authority called police officers who investigate and have to take this information and then convert it into reasonable grounds to lay a charge. Mm-hmm. We need to be much more mindful of this garbage and make sure it doesn't go ahead. Because, you know, as I've had lunch with somebody who said to me very poignantly, who is in policing, that the power to lay a charge is probably one of the most powerful authorities that we have in our society. That is an incredible power that has a lasting impact. And that was acknowledged. And this is a very smart, seasoned officer. And we need more of that at the front end to assess a lot of this junk. Mm-hmm. And the power area and relabeling it through therapy 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 years later or more can be really, 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 really dangerous as we move forward.
Yeah, and it's also difficult too because there's real limitations on what kind of evidence you can call about somebody's therapy because it's deemed to be, you know, very invasive on the person's privacy, and they want to encourage, as I always say, victims, not complaints, encourage victims to get therapy and to get help.
Well, look, people should be able to get therapy with freedom that, you know, lawyers and other people aren't going to delve into it. And I got to say, in 31 years, I went after therapy records once, mm-hmm. just once. Yeah. But there are occasions where, based upon the admitted statements of a complainant, where right. they say, in my therapy, I was told the following by my therapist, and that's a result of why now I think this is, that's one of those cases where I'd want to go after those records.
Right.
Because, and based upon the experts we've had here, that's insidious and that can be a real problem. But people have to have the confidence that they can go for therapy, even if they're going to be in a criminal case, that it's not going to be unduly invaded. I get that. Yeah. But there are certain therapeutic modalities that take reality and distort it and results in false accusations. I mean, that there's no doubt about that.
And just to tie it back to the whole, you know, where we started off with what does power actually mean? I mean, this is going to be a really important area of law to really clarify, because
what
there's
is
a lot of
power?
People who could be, you know, who could be said to be in a position of power, or it's not necessarily a position of like employment kind of thing, but to be exercising some sort of power, and they would never believe it to be true because they didn't feel powerful in that relationship.
That's right. That's right.
And that's a consideration too. Like, but,
and
we're talking about with intent.
And why would that
powerful?
Be the case? Because there's a human interaction. There's a psychological component. There's many other factors at play in a relationship where a person who on the chart might seem to be in a position of power doesn't feel they're in a position of power. In reality, they're not. Mm-hmm. That's where I see that this can go, you know, very badly askew.
Yeah. And this particular issue, I think, is why people get frustrated sometimes with lawyers and judges and the whole legal system, is because it seems sometimes to be just arguing about words. And they're like, there's lives at stake here. And it just sounds sometimes like we're just arguing about words.
Well, this book is full of words. I mean, this is the Criminal Code of Canada. So if you're going to get charged, it's going to be under one of these sections. And it's full of words and interpretation and full of case law, you know, that can fill rooms and rooms, or, you know, terabytes of space on computers. I mean, we are stuck with words, and words are important.
They are.
And interpreting this is important.
The interpretation is the job of the judges. So the, you know, legislation our parliament writes the laws, and the judges interpret what those words mean. And there's a thing now called the living tree doctrine, in which the meaning of words can change over time. This is versus what they call the originalists, who say it should be...
Yeah, you see a lot more of that in the United States than you do in Canada.
No, I've seen a fair bit.
Yeah, well, yeah.
There's more living tree proponents, I would say.
Look, certain understandings of, you know, charter rights and laws and interpretation can evolve over time. But there's a lot of our interpretation which is fairly defined by the case law that has come out over decades of litigation. So, you know, we have that precedent and we have that stare decisis. So it's not completely the same as the United States. There is a bit of a difference, you know, the fights between, you know, the originalists, etc. And I don't want to get into that debate right now, but
no, the important point is that, you know, that word, the meaning of words can change over time. As they say, society has grown in our awareness and such, and so we have to interpret this in a different way now.
And what I see is that these power dynamics can change significantly based upon interest groups lobbying against government, educating judges, and influencing our system. Just like we spoke in another episode about, you know, whether violence is gendered, right?
Right.
And that will frame our understanding and our interpretation. And that's where I'm worried. And that's why, you know, if we get some clear statements about, you know, the state of mind of the accused and the subjective intent of the accused to then act upon a position of power to create an inducement or influence a person into a sexual act, we'll have clarity that I think is needed here so that we can insulate from abuse in the future.
Yeah, and that's kind of why we're so excited about this case, because it's an opportunity to help define that word and to hopefully set a good precedent on what it does or does not mean.
I have great confidence it will be. You know, we're very concerned about our client who's gone through a long journey, and it's been extremely difficult for him. There has been struggles for the complainant in this case, not related to our client, and so we hope she heals and has a good life. It's just been an unfortunate confluence of issues for these two people, but we hope that what comes out of this is more clarity that will then prevent against abuse of these terms, because there's so much noise that wants to change these paradigms. You know, it's like the we hear about, let's get rid of parental alienation, let's get rid of this term because we believe in this and we believe in that, based upon nothing, no science, no study. Okay, you want to go. Thank you. That was a good talk, eh? Diane's checked out now. Time to go.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I'm just looking forward to
pillow talk
with hopefully we'll have a good result on this. So in the meantime, if you like this episode and want to see more, don't forget to like, comment, subscribe, and share.
And keep sending us your ideas. Oh, let me just say this at the end. So somebody who does view our episodes, I don't want them to feel that we're not paying attention to it. So I'm not going to use the last name. So Robert messaged us over Telegram because we have our podcast. So thank you very much on it. So it allows chats. And they're asking, Joseph, would you or Diana or both of you, probably both of us because we're here, consider doing an episode on cross-examination and court tricks that the prosecution use against falsely accused domestic violence and sexual assault defendants, which is really an interesting topic because we have a couple of cases coming up. And I wouldn't call them tricks, but I'd call it strategic and tactical cross-examination techniques by Crown attorneys, which you can see can lead to possibly answers that do not really get to the truth of the matter. So that's a great topic. We're going to do that in the future. So that's what I mean. Keep writing us. Thank you. That's a great idea, and we're going to do it.
We shall see you soon.
Have a good night, everybody. Ciao.